Lecture 17, Renaissance Attitudes Toward Teaching English.
Hello and welcome back to the Renaissance. In this lecture, Lecture 17, I'm going to talk about some ways in which English changed not just in pronunciation or in idiom, but in spelling. And following up on some material of my previous lecture, I'm moving towards the shape of what seems to us to be modern everyday English. But central to that movement are the institutions that helped calibrate what constitutes good English usage. One of the themes of this course of lectures, as I've stated, is the way in which education and its institutions help to shape the making of English. What is a standard? Why do we speak the way we do? Why do we not speak the way we spell? What is the relationship between writing and speech? These kinds of questions are asked anew in the 16th and 17th century by grammarians, pedagogues, and scholars of the language in order to make claims for social hierarchy and political control. Before I get into this material, however, I think this might be a good time to review some of the major issues that are involved in the shifts from Middle English to Modern English. I've gone through some technical materials in some of my earlier lectures, and I want to just look systematically now, for a few minutes, at the three major areas of change during this period: vocabulary, syntax and grammar, and spelling and pronunciation. We saw in an earlier lecture how the period from about the year 1500 to the year 1700 was a period in which the English vocabulary increased dramatically. The rise of coined words, inkhorn terms, words borrowed or fashioned out of Latin and Greek, radically increased the vocabulary available for science, technology, and intellectual inquiry. But also new loanwords were coming into the language, words from colonial contact, from commerce, and from trade, which brought words from other European languages and also words from non-European languages into English. The root word stock, as it were, of the English language increases dramatically during this period. And of course, just to anticipate again, lectures on Shakespeare, which will follow, Shakespeare is also very much involved in increasing the word stock of English. Shakespeare's vocabulary, in fact, runs to tens of thousands of different words. And many of the words that we have as part of our language are, if not Shakespearean coinages, words that Shakespeare brought in and, in effect, made canonical for English literary use. Furthermore, in an earlier lecture, I had mentioned the idea of polysemy, and this is also an important category for looking at vocabulary. Polysemy is the condition of a word which has several different meanings. And as words were changing meaning over time, during the 16th and 17th centuries, a single word could carry several different meanings or connotations. Shakespeare and the writers of his time also exploit polysemy as a resource for describing the world and characterizing intellectual and social change. Syntax and grammar. In my previous lecture, I tried to show how changes in morphology, that is, in the shape or form of words and particles, was making English more idiomatic, how the language of literature, of everyday speech, and of social and ecclesiastical ritual was being changed by even such little words as do or such tiny particles as ing. Here, word order is now to some degree being replaced by new vocabulary terms as the primary bearer of meaning. Spelling and pronunciation. I have talked about the great vowel shift as a phenomenon which we can see beginning in the mid-15th century, but which is hard to see ending. The great vowel shift did not close down, as it were, with finality. And this is an important point. Certainly by the 16th century, the sounds of English vowels had changed radically from earlier pronunciations. Remember, even earlier, in the passage I read to you from William Caxton's preface to his Enedos, which he printed in 1490, Caxton had said in that preface that the use and manner of speech of that day, 1490, was very different from the kind of speech that he remembered from the time when he was a child, about 60 or so years before. And one of the things that Caxton may be reflecting on is the great vowel shift in its earliest developments. You'll remember that the written evidence for the great vowel shift in personal letters and diaries, evidence that I had mentioned in an earlier lecture, suggests that in the mid-15th century, things are already beginning to change. By the end of the 15th century, a man like Caxton can remember a time when people simply sounded different. Now, by the year 1700 or so, the great vowel shift had pretty much run its course, and there are few sound changes since that time of the staggering significance of the great vowel shift. But there are a few details that I think actually are worth mentioning. One of them, as I had mentioned earlier, and which I'd like to recall again, is the way in which certain words rhyme in earlier poetry and don't rhyme anymore. And this is because the sound shift hadn't completed itself, or at least hadn't resolved itself into what we see as modern forms. The old sounds E and U from Middle English that became the diphthongs I and ow were, in their transitional stages, diphthongs more with sounds like oi and o. And it's this kind of pronunciation that enables a poet like Alexander Pope to rhyme a word line, L-I-N-E, with a word join, J-O-I-N, and that they rhymed probably on something like line and join. And we will see in subsequent lectures on Shakespeare how certain words can rhyme because the shift in sounds was in a transitional period, and certain sounds were falling together. Now, it's this moment of sonic change that provokes in the 16th and 17th centuries new reflections on how people should speak, how people do speak, and what the relationship is between spelling and pronunciation. One of the things that happens in this period is that schoolmasters take it upon themselves to reform spelling. And in fact, reform is the word that's used in the debates among these schoolmasters to describe what exactly is going on. Let me give you some examples of this. Many words entered English in the Middle English period from French, and we've seen lots and lots of them. Because French is a Romance language, those words ultimately descend from Latin. During the 16th and 17th century, English education, even though it's going on in English, is still very much involved in the study of Latin, Latin roots or Latin etymologies, the reading and writing of Latin. What scholars and pedagogues noticed was, of course, that words from French had Latin originals. But the point that changes this attitude, or the thing that distinguishes that simple awareness of an origin from a change in spelling, is the argument that words should be respelled as if they were Latin words. What's emerging in the 16th and 17th century is a new concept of English spelling, and that is that English spelling should be historical and etymological, even if that spelling really doesn't reflect the actual history of the word. So, for example, a word like debt, D-E-B-T, or a word like doubt, D-O-U-B-T, these words came in from French. Now, when they came in from French, they were not spelled with the B. Debt, D-E-T-T-E, would be the Middle English spelling, or doubt, in Middle English, doute, D-O-U-T-E, because they're borrowed from the French. Schoolmasters of the 16th and 17th centuries, however, insisted on spelling these words D-E-B-T and D-O-U-B-T, because they believed that they were ultimately descended from Latin verbs like debitare and dubitare. This is a historical way of spelling, but not really. And we read these and we sort of intuitively say things like, oh, there's a silent letter there, as if at one point that letter was pronounced. But the silent letters in words like debt and doubt are different from the silent letters in words like night and knee. Night and knee are truly etymological and historical spellings, because in Old English and in Middle English you would have really said knicht, or you would have said knay. Debt and doubt are not. They're, as it were, spelling fantasies of schoolmasters who imagine Latin roots behind them. Some other examples, a word like adventure comes from the old French aventure, which means a journey, a way into something. And it's the word used to describe the genre of literary romance. But these same scholars saw aventure as advenire, the going into or the going towards. And so they respelled it as adventure. A word like perfect comes from French. In Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, the description of the character of the knight in the general prologue is he's a very parfait, gentil knicht. He's a true and perfect gentle knight. But parfait is the French, perfect. Again, the schoolmaster imagines this as a Latin word. And another good example is verdict, which in French was simply voir dire. And again in Chaucer, who takes the word from the French legal vocabulary. Chaucer's host in the Canterbury Tales asks each of the pilgrims on that journey to tell a story. In fact, to tell two stories, going towards Canterbury and two stories coming back from Canterbury. And at the end of the journey, the host says that they will all judge who has told the best story, and that person will get a dinner at everyone else's expense. And the word that the host uses to describe the judgment of the literary merit of the tale teller is voir dit. The voir dit. Dit, the saying. The verdict, the true saying. The judgment passed. Voir dit in French, but for these 16th and 17th century pedagogues who can only see the Latin behind it, it is respelled as verdict. Now, these are specific examples. How do they constellate into a cultural attitude? I think the first thing that emerges that we need to see is that spelling itself becomes a social accomplishment. That is, what happens in the 16th and 17th century, almost for the first time, I think, in the history of English, is that good or proper spelling is the mark of literacy. Spelling is the mark of learning or education. If you do not spell well, you are considered an illiterate. And indeed, today, our pedagogic preoccupations with good spelling, with typographical error, with copy editing and correction, are in many ways the lineal descendants of the attitudes of these Renaissance schoolmasters. What emerges at this time, then, is not just spelling as a mark of education or ability, but of the idea of educated speech as the new standard. Now, you'll remember from earlier lectures that standards in English were very often regional dialects that came to be pressed into the service of literary or political activity. The West Saxon dialect of Old English becomes something like a standard because it is the dialect of King Alfred. It is the dialect in which Old English poetry and prose is written or rewritten. Or the East Midland dialect that becomes the London dialect of Chaucer and of the 15th century becomes, in effect, a standard. Standards are based on the appropriation of certain regional dialects, and in particular, regional dialects that correspond to the place where the king or the court or the universities were located, Oxford and Cambridge. In the 16th and 17th century, what changes is the idea of education. And the belief emerged that an educated person from any part of England should be able to speak, write, and spell in the same way. Education, in effect, effaces geographical boundaries. This is a new idea. Furthermore, what emerges is the idea of education itself as a conferral of class or status. Now, it's not just region that gets to be effaced or blurred, but it's birth. Any individual can be educated enough at a certain point to rise to power or to prominence. This is also a new and, of course, in the Renaissance, incredibly socially threatening idea. Why should the son of a shoemaker become a courtier? Why should the son of a vintner become a poet? Why should the son of a glove maker become a dramatist? This is a new idea that's reinforced in the institutions of the schools, of the universities, of the so-called inns of court, where legal scholars and lawyers were trained. It's in the idea of the laureate. Just to pause, the idea of a poet laureate. This is a relatively new concept, but the notion of laureation is, in fact, quite old. Back in the Middle Ages, if you had a university degree, if you had a BA, you were a laureate. A laureate just means that you got the laurel crown. The Italian poet Petrarch, in the middle of the 14th century, stages his own laureation. He basically gives himself an honorary degree. And he manages to get the laurel crown placed on his head, and he gives a great speech. And this is really something that looks back to old Roman practice, but it's also something that anticipates a lot of modern university practice, the idea of the honorary degree or the laureateship. So throughout the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, a lot of educated people started calling themselves laureates, and they started selling their services to kings or princes or potentates because they were educated, they knew languages, and so could function as interpreters. Or they could read, and very often the kings could not. And they could function then as public readers. Or they knew the customs of different countries. Many of the poets of the Renaissance are in fact diplomats. Chaucer, even in the Middle Ages, was a diplomat of a sort who was sent on diplomatic and commercial missions to France and Italy. Thomas Wyatt is a diplomat to Spain. Many of the courtiers are diplomats, and many of the people who write on English language are diplomats and scholars. They take education, as it were, as a resource. What one might even say is that education becomes not just a resource, but it becomes a commodity. That is, it's something that you buy and something that you sell. And this is what emerges in the schools and universities of the 16th and early 17th centuries. And when teachers and schoolmasters start to write on attitudes towards language, they take education as this model. Now, I'd like to investigate a few of these writings to look at the texture of criticism on English. In the 1560s, a pedagogue named John Hart said that the best English was, and I'm quoting, "the English of the learned and the literate, which every reasonable Englishman will the best he can frame his tongue thereunto." This is a marvelous phrase here, the idea that learning and literacy should be equated with reasonableness, as if learning and literate was to be equated with a quality of mind. Alexander Gill, from whom I have quoted at great length in earlier lectures, Milton's teacher at St. Paul's, writing in his Logonomia Anglica of 1619, felt that spelling itself should be reformed according to the usage of the educated and the refined. I'll read a little extended quote. He says, "that in manners the opinion of the good, so in pronunciation the custom of the learned, is to be taken as a basis. All spelling is to be accommodated to the sound used not by plowmen, maidservants, and porters, but by learned or elegantly refined men in speaking and writing. I mean, just think of this. This is a history of English class relationships phrased in a sentence on spelling reform, as if, you know, plowmen, maidservants, and porters represented not just bad speech, but bad speech as a phenomenon of class, of servitude. Now, Thomas Putnam and Owen Price reflected not just on education, but on region as well. Putnam is famous for his study of the art of rhetoric, which he published in 1589. And he talks about the speech of English, the best English, and here's the passage I want to read, as the usual speech of the court. Now, this is very interesting now. It's about courtiership. And he says, and that of London and the shires lying about London, within about 50 miles and not much above. As if there was a kind of, you know, bar line, 50 or 60 miles out of London, when all of a sudden speech just became regional, dialectical, bad. But he says this, I say this not, but that in every shire of England there be gentlemen and others that speak, but especially write as good southern as we of Middlesex or Surrey do, but not the common people of every shire, to whom the gentlemen and also their learned clerks do for the most part condescend. Now here the idea is regionalism combined with education. If you live in a region of England, like in the north, and you're educated, what you're going to read and write and speak is really Southern English. Remember Trevisa, who thought and spoke of the language of people in the north, especially at York, as sharp, slitting, frothing, and unsharp. And that sort of wonderful onomatopoetic constellation of sounds there. Well, similarly, now in the end of the 16th century, two centuries after John of Trevisa, Putnam can say something very similar. A century later, a man named Owen Price, in a book which he called The Vocal Organ, a description of how sounds are made, he says, I have not been guided by our vulgar pronunciation, but by that of London and our universities where the language is purely spoken. Now, Owen Price is one of these individuals in the 17th century who becomes fascinated with the possibility of actually recording how people wrote. There's a very technical and convoluted and beautifully 17th century in Cornish word for these kinds of people. And they were orthoapists. Orthoapy is simply right writing, right spelling. Orthoapists tried to develop what we might now call ways of phonetically transcribing how people spoke. And Owen Price and others, in fact, just parenthetically, Isaac Newton was very interested in this. And Newton has a treatise on the possibility of actually recording how people spoke. Price and other orthoapists tried to develop ways of actually going out and recording how people spoke. They are the 17th century precursors of Henry Higgins. And just like Higgins, in Shaw's fictional version of it, they were able to claim that they could tell exactly where you came from, exactly how well you were educated, by the way in which you pronounced certain vowels. And works like The Vocal Organ are not just full of pronouncements like this, but they're full of pictures of mouths and heads in strange contorted shapes. And under each of them, there is a vowel or a consonant written. Ah, oh, ah. And these are like grotesqueries of pronunciation, so that when you look at somebody's face, you could actually see what was going on. And of course, the pedagogical implication of this was the way to teach people to pronounce things correctly was to manipulate their face in a certain kind of way so that they could physically form the sounds in the best way. And so, when Price says, I have not been guided by our vulgar pronunciation, that's what he's talking about. How to actually physically shape your face to make something right. And vulgar here is a beautiful word because it's standing on the cusp of meaning, of polysemy, of semantic change. The Latin vulgar really just means common or everyday, the people. Vulgar Latin is a word that means the Latin of the common people, everyday Latin. But in the 17th century, a word like vulgar now comes to mean the kinds of words that vulgar people speak. Plowmen, maidservants, and porters, to go back to Gill, are vulgar because they may be common. But what would you hear a plowman or a maidservant or a porter actually say? What you might hear are vulgarities. And so when Price says vulgar pronunciation, he really means both things. He's not just talking about the common people, but he's really evoking a sense of almost vulgarity in here. How did we reform spelling? How were arguments made for the reform of spelling? Well, Gill and Mulcaster, Richard Mulcaster, were very much involved in spelling reform. Richard Mulcaster was the first director of the Merchant Taylors' School. And if Gill, later at St. Paul's, was Milton's teacher, Mulcaster was the teacher of Edmund Spenser, the poet of the Faerie Queen. Mulcaster argued that English spelling was fine as it was. And any attempt to reform spelling, he said, would, and his phrase is, cumber our tongue. Would encumber our tongue, he says, both with strange characts, that is, with odd or unusual characters, and with needless diphthongs. Now, I think this is very interesting, because I use the word diphthong in a very technical way in this class, in this set of lectures, and yet now he's talking about strange and needless diphthongs. That is, the way in which, if you wanted to make spelling reflect speech, you'd have to have so many vowels written down, because there are no pure sounds anymore, that it would make it impossible to read. It would be an encumbrance. And he went on and he said, if they want distinction between words, then accent must be meant to avoid confusion, or some such device which may distinguish with praise and not pester the writing with any too odd strangeness. One of the key terms that's emerged, it seems to me, in this course of lectures, is the term alien or strange. Whenever you see something you don't like, it's alien or strange. And whenever you see something you do like, it's familiar. But it's also part of the birth tongue, or the wellspring, or the genius of England. Gill, however, was in favor of spelling reform. Gill said, nothing contributes so much to the fame of a people as their language. Not skill in warfare, not knowledge of literature. For through language, these things are made known amongst the people, bequeathed to foreigners and handed down to posterity. Now, there's something amazing about a statement like that. The idea here that language is part of national identity. And he goes on, none of the languages now spoken by men will be found to be more graceful or elegant or apt for the expression of every subtle thought than English. Admittedly, numerous faults which impede the studies of our youth have crept into our language. But by bringing back these characters used by our forefathers in antiquity, neglected though indifference in former times, and by introducing one or two ones, I have so restored them all that any inexperienced person will be immediately able to perceive at first sight the proper sound of our words. What Gill wants to do is develop a new system of spelling so that the real genius wellspring tone of English can be immediately perceivable to anybody. Gill, in a sort of curious way, is also writing out a narrative of a kind of colonial experience. English is the best and most graceful and elegant language. We're going to see statements like this later in the course, where we see how some people would argue that English is the best, the most elegant, the most apt. Otto Jespersen, a Danish linguist of the 19th and 20th century, would argue, in fact, that not only was English the best, but English was the most virile, inflecting now with a gendered tone the quality and power of the language. Where all these arguments go is to a larger claim for the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries about what came to be called the genius of English. And genius here doesn't simply mean an individual who's smarter than anybody else. It means the source of imagination, the wellspring. What really is English and what is not? My next two lectures will be about Shakespeare's English, where we can see Shakespeare taking what is and maybe is not English and bringing it together into a powerful and literary synthesis. And then, in subsequent lectures on the making of dictionaries, on Johnson's Dictionary, on the Oxford English Dictionary, and on the translation of the Bible into English, we will see lexicographers, scholars, translators, poets, and pedants ask and answer the question in their own way. What is English and what is not? What is the genius of the tongue and what only cumbers our expression? Thank you.